Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we will have our technique of the week. As always, our culinary conundrums, which we absolutely love getting in. They're coming in by the bucket load these days. And we have Chris Connolly running 5K with Chris, I think is his tag. Gareth, actually just fresh from a wee 5K last Friday.
It's Gareth. Almost like I'm bringing these people on that I'm running with just to show that I'm running all the time and you're not. That's never ever that.
We were stuck for a guest, so we sent Gareth out running with Chris and then he says, I'm only doing it if you come on my show, dude. You know what I mean? So I'm really looking forward to talking to him. Actually, he looks like he's good crack, that guy. So don't go anywhere. So it's cooking technique of the week time. What are you going with, Gareth?
So we're going with pan roasting. So pan roasting is a technique that's probably the most used technique in a kitchen.
And you know what's funny? I had a mouthpiece who works in the food world in Ireland. One time, questioned that when I had it written on a menu one time.
Pan roasted something.
She goes, you don't know what you're talking about. It was pan roast. Whenever I goes, excuse me? And she was like, what's pan roast? I says, I tell you what, it goes, leave the menu writing to chefs and leave the pan roasting to chefs and don't be annoying me. But very, very condescending. I always remember that conversation and I'm glad you're also a fan of the pan roast. So explain to our listeners what that is exactly.
So really, I would say that what most people do at home that we do differently in a professional environment is we start things in a frying pan. Like, and I'll give you a recipe while I'm explaining it, because I think a lot of people will cook a chicken breast at home, a skin-on chicken breast with the wing on, and they'll probably put it onto a tray, they'll drizzle it with a little bit of oil, and they might put it on a few vegetables and season it with some salt and pepper and pop it into an oven. But in a professional environment, if you order a chicken Caesar salad or you order, if you're in a gastro pub or something and it's a pan seared chicken on a bed of mash or whatever, most of that will happen in a frying pan. So what they'll do is they'll put a frying pan on, they'll get it nice and hot, you'll add a little bit of oil into that pan and then you'll season that chicken breast and put it in skin side down in the pan. And what you're doing is you're going after that chicken breast with intense heat to roast it up. And then at some point what you'll do is you'll probably add in some butter and you'll add in some herbs and some garlic and then you'll pop it into the oven to finish that process. And if it was a chicken breast, you'd leave the chicken skin side down because you want that chicken breast touching off the skillet or the pan, and when it's in the oven, it's going to roast up. And that pan roasting
renders
the fat, gets it nice and crispy. It'll cook that chicken breast in a professional convection oven in about 12 minutes, depending on how much work you've done on the pan before it goes in. And that's how we cook a chicken breast from being in a fridge raw all the way to cooked in about 15 minutes by the time you cook it and roast it and rest it. That technique is also used for pieces of fish on the bone, so a little bit of turbot or a piece of halibut or a Dover sole, like
the thicker meatier fish that you would be filleting.
Yeah, we'll have to go into the oven as well. That's where the pan roast, and where if it's a piece of sea bass, you'll just be pan fry it skin side down. You won't have to put it into the oven because there's enough heat going on there. So that technique, whether you're cooking a duck leg confit or a duck breast or a chicken breast or a pork chop even or a lamb chop, you'd be using that heat of the skillet pan to render down the fat and give that fat something for it to roast in, and then it'll be popped into the oven. Because you might have, if you have a full restaurant with 40, 50, 60 diners and they're all ordering different bits, cuts of meat and bits of fish, it's pan work supported with an oven. Yeah. So pan roasting is
whenever the meat or the fish or the lamb or the pork or whatever it is, it's just too thick too big to be cooked alone by shallow frying, and you need the technique of both.
Yeah.
Where it's pan, started, seared, and then into the oven.
And nine times out of ten, the pan and all goes into the oven.
Oh, so like,
yeah. I mean, some chefs set up their ovens where they have a tray in there that's staying nice and hot. But really, it's continuous
heat. Do you do that thing when you're buying frying pans, Gaz, that you're only ever buying metal handles as well?
Yeah, of course.
Because you know that, right, if ever I have a wagon on that someday, I just want to be able to burst it into the oven. Because obviously wooden handles or anything rubber or plastic or the death nail, they're no good to you.
Yeah, and I think at home you get away with a little bit. Like most of those Teflon and plastic handles, they will last a little bit.
Yeah.
But in a professional environment where there's 10, 15, 20 pans on the go and they're going from an oven underneath it to a salamander or a grill, you're talking about this intense heat all the time. So yeah, cast iron skillet pans is really what we use, and we've spoken about how to season them, but that's all around the work of pan roasting.
Yeah.
I think I shared a recipe a few weeks ago of some chicken thighs on the bone where I said about using a cassoulet dish. That's kind of like, that was a pan roasting technique really, getting the skin crispy, then getting it into the oven to finish it off. So I don't know whether you need to share a recipe, but it's that technique.
Yeah, really, it's a technique. Yeah, but look, I suppose the ones that really, really stand out would be, depending who you are, like if you're my old boy and you like a thick steak, but you like it well done, you really need to actually use the oven to finish it because, you know, if you're going to, it's a big thing in the States or whatever, like, and it's the same with me. I love a steak that's thick. A fillet steak is probably a perfect example. Even if you want a fillet steak medium, it's very, very difficult to get an 8-ounce fillet steak.
It has to go cooked, into the oven.
Cooked medium. You can't really do it. Like, so you're going to be pan roasting that. So that's actually the perfect example of nearly every fillet steak would absolutely, because you've got to get the caramelization on the outer part of the fillet. You've got to close it in. You've got to seal in the juice and the blood, and then you get it in the oven to finish. But yeah, look, again, like I mentioned, it would be when it'd be thicker steaks like that I would use it, always with chicken breast, obviously pan roasted, and then halibut. I don't eat tons of fish, but when I do, salmon or halibut. And again, look, what you can play around, and probably salmon, yeah, depending on how I would manipulate it and cut it, you could get away with just flash frying it and pan frying it and basting it then on a lower heat. But the quickest and best way is the pan roasting technique, and it's just using that pan and oven together and making sure that your oven is preheated, obviously, before you start, because the last thing you want is coming from that level of heat and then not forgetting that your oven isn't preheated to 180 or 200, depending on what it is that you're cooking. So yeah, good wee technique, and one that I know I use almost every time I cook, I would say. Like I'm pan roasting, which always brings you back to why that person I'd love to name used to drive me mental with.
Not that you're willing to hold a grudge.
Yeah. But it's an amazing, though, like the arrogance of some people that you meet, like going, you don't know what you're talking about, pan roasting.
It made me think of, there's so many different styles of writing menus. Some chefs write the technique, some of them just write the ingredient. And it's really just making sure that whatever you're giving the guest is there, you know. Like, I think some people get a little bit caught up with different.
Yeah, well, menus aren't supposed to be books either, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to be reading too much, but equally, you know,
not what you're getting.
It's nice to know, like, when I see, like, if I'm in the market before the board, gosh, Bacora or whatever, and you see pan roasted breast of chicken, whatever, like I know already, oh, it's going to be lovely and crispy skin. You know, I can read between the lines, and I'm like going, oh, yeah, I'm all over that. Here we go. It's not fucking steamed. It's not white. It's not whatever. It's not poached. It's not, I goes, pan roasted all day long. I'm in the mood for that now. So for those that know, it's important, you know what I mean? So yeah, good one. Let's rock on.
Today we have a fella in with us that's after getting famous for running 5Ks. Now we know that my co-producer has ran a marathon or two because he never bleeds and shuts up about it. But we have Chris. I actually don't know your second name. I only know you as 5K, but Chris.
Connolly.
Chris Connolly, you're very welcome into the podcast.
Chris Connolly, if you didn't work in TV, they would give you that name, I'd say.
Yeah.
That's a stage name. What's your real name?
So I was lucky enough to do the 5K, which on Friday, and I didn't know what to expect. But very, very interesting. It was over an hour, wasn't it? We ran probably a little bit more than 5K. But tell us a little bit about your backstory and what this is all about to people that don't know.
Yeah, so I suppose like from the start, I struggled with addiction. I struggled with drink, drugs, alcohols, and never really understanding who I was as an individual, which just led me down a bad road. And it wasn't until I decided to turn a corner. Obviously, there's a big story behind that, but ultimately, running was a staple in me getting sober and getting better. And from there, I just became in love with exercising, with growing.
You're a PT, are you? Like that's
so. I used to be a personal trainer. Yeah. At the moment, I'm a men's health worker.
Okay.
So I work with men's health and elderly men and helping them to communicate with each other and sort of socialise as well. But yeah, like the whole running, the whole idea behind the 5K with Chris was when I was in treatment. I used to look at people on the internet and think to myself, how the fuck did they get where they are today? And then, yeah. I don't know, one day I just said...
Gareth thinks that all the time. When he looks across the studio at me, he's like, how can I just one day be as good as that lad? I wish I could cook like that man, he thinks. Hey, come here, when you say addiction, Chris, because I mean, I don't know you maybe as good as Gareth does. Mm. Like, how long, say, were you... abusing drugs or drink, or like what was the worst phase or the biggest one, or is it a wee mixture of all? Like, but was it a 5-10 year period or longer again? Or
yeah, so would have started off when I was around 17, 18 years of age. I started to get into the whole scene of steroids, was more or less my first thing to get into
from training,
yeah, from training. Because one thing as a young age, I could never really understand who I was, and I always had acne and I was skinny and I felt like I never fit in.
Yeah.
And in order for me to fit in, I just started...
You wanted to get bigger.
Exactly. Wanted to start hanging around with a couple of little lads, acting the bollocks, you know, getting involved in everything that every young fella thinks is going to make them something that they're not. And before I knew it, I started juicing.
You're right, though, because I was super tiny. I mean, I'm not that I grew much, like, but I mean, I was tiny on a level, like when I was... a teenager at school, and you're just like, but I always remember going, please let the football trial start.
Yeah.
And it was overnight, man. You went from getting your hole kicked at school to you're one of the best players in the fucking school now, or up there anyways. And your life changed every day. So it is tough when you're a teenager or going into them years, like, and you're looking for something. And the
first time you were offered steroids, was that in the gym?
I was going to say, were you offered or did you go looking? Or
so it's like in the gym, it's there regardless. It's like, do you ever hear that old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear?
Yeah.
Whenever you're ready to find something, you're going to find it regardless, because it's your destiny almost that you're manifesting. I just got introduced to certain people who were taking steroids, and before I knew it, I took it, and it was like instantaneously.
But see, when you take a steroid then, I mean, you still need to be lifting, right? You still need to be working out.
But do you
just see gains? Did you see like a transition
just
right away?
Overnight. And it wasn't even about the physical, the aesthetics for me. It was the attention. It was the validation. And it then manifested into me then trying to go around and have sex with as many women as I could.
Yeah.
Because I was never seen when I was a young fella. And now all of a sudden everybody was seeing me for this young fella whose muscles and everything else. And sort of, I was portraying a falsified image of myself, and I was just getting away with it.
Yeah, I don't know where I heard it, but it was a couple of years ago. It must have been a documentary or something that was an RT or whatever. And they did this undercover thing about steroids in gyms in Dublin. In particular, it seemed to be like north, inner city Dublin and beyond. You know what I mean? Like, you hate that it's nearly that neck of the woods that they're always sort of picking on or looking for. But then that's where it was done anyway. I mean, I was never naive that there'd be lots of steroids. I had 6 years in Boston, and I used to see it like here and there, but more with the bigger dudes. But I was blown away by how rampant it was in Ireland. Like, you know, it's probably supposed to be no more than the cocaine use nowadays. Like, it's actually easier to get than a pint.
And most people's perception of someone that's taking steroids for muscular gain or muscular growth or whatever, they never think of it around addiction.
No.
You know, like, people will just think, oh, these are really fit guys trying to get quicker or faster, or obviously the world of cycling is probably the most publicised addiction use that's being exposed. But it's across all levels of sport. I know some sports are better than testing than others. But then you went from that type of addiction into something a little bit more sinister, I suppose. Yeah, or maybe not.
You touched on it there a minute ago, cocaine. Yeah. So, like, I obviously, it was, like, the whole thing about addiction, like, the substance is regardless. It's about the deep underlying issues that I had from a young age where I felt never enough. I was always looking to portray a falsified image of myself so I could just fit in, or I could start to be seen as somebody who I wasn't because I was afraid. You know, I was always acting out of fear. But when it led me down the road of taking drugs and trying drugs, it was like a whole new world had opened up. And at the time, I didn't really realise, but all I was trying to do was chase feel-good feelings because I wanted to get away from all that hurt, fear and trauma that I had experienced from a younger age.
Yeah, Jesus.
And did it work?
For the most part of it, like you think you're getting away with these things, you know, and this is what I don't try to force all this onto young people, but it's something that's really true to my heart because I want the young kids and the young men to know that this, you'll get away with it for the first year or 2 years, and then before you know it, your whole fucking life falls to pieces.
And what did that look like for us? Because I'm a little bit concerned that we're glorifying what was going on, because you've only told us the positives of this it. So how did it spiral then?
So before I knew it then, I had met a girl, and an absolutely lovely girl, and fell in love with her. But ultimately, I was acting and behaving in ways that were completely not me. And it was all to start to please me addiction, or start to keep hanging around with the boys and fuck off.
And was that the Chris that she liked?
No, that's
she,
not
she
who
preferred
she,
you the way you are now,
yeah. And ultimately, I went down the road of just completely abusing the relationship mentally, you know. I was never around. I was always in the pub, out drinking and staying out on nights out. And we had a kid and all together. I was never there for my daughter, you know, which ultimately led to her leaving me. And when she left me, I always say that, and I'll continue to say it because it's something that stands true to me. When you're doing good in life, it's like an upward spiral. But when you're doing bad, it's a very quick downward spiral. You know, and that was the case for me. I went I lost my relationship, I lost my daughter, I lost my family, I lost a job. And then before I knew it then, I also lost the whole power of cocaine. Cocaine just gave up on me, and I loved cocaine. And
it's mad to hear.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that? Like, you were taking it and it was doing nothing for you.
It was doing nothing for me. Yeah, and then
was that just the amount that you're consuming? Because I came very close once to taking cocaine. I remember being at a party at Boston, and again, most of the football team, most of the boys, a lot of the ones in our industry were there, and this tray came around the room like a silver service tray that Gareth and I would be familiar with. I remember turning around to one of my boys, Shamey, and saying, like, what the fuck's that there? He goes, is that what I think it is? And he goes, aye, aye, mucker. And then, anyway, he was a northern boy, you know. Next thing, the tray came by me, and there was this slight, as it came to me, like, the hand on, I kind of slowed down, and I went, no, I fucking love that. And that is literally what went through my head. I goes, no, I'm going to fucking love that.
Yeah.
And I passed on the tray. And every now and again, for a few years after that, I'd say, Jesus, thank God there was a strength in me there that just knew that you're a fucking mad enough whore now and you're going to really, really enjoy that. For everything I'd heard about it, I was like, it's right up your fucking street. Move on. You get enough crack. Thankfully, you had a music, food and beer was never a problem. Like, you know what I mean? But it was a sliding door moment, like when you think, because I know lots now that they still need a wee bit here and there. Like, but was it volume then or just fuck this, like, I don't want to do it anymore?
That's what happened, like, to me, and I don't want this to come across the wrong way, but a lot of people always say drugs are bad, but they are bad, but for me they were so fucking good because they took me away from the reality that I was living. Don't get me wrong, I was living in absolute hell, but up here I was convincing myself that this was the life that I wanted. I was sitting underneath bridges and I was sniffing cocaine. I'd have a 6-pack of cans and I was convincing
on
myself,
your own,
on my own.
I
was saying, this is the fucking best. I don't have to listen to war talking shy, or I don't have to listen to a screaming kid, and I'm under a fucking bridge sniffing cocaine. cocaine, Jesus. Not a bleeding penny in me pocket. But it all progressed very similar towards what you were saying. At a party, couple little lads, silver tray. Wasn't that fancy, a silver tray? Yeah. What the fuck? He's like something out of Pulp Fiction. Silver tray. Yeah. But yeah, that's the way it starts, right, man? And it starts so organically and so fucking... almost like what you said, like where you're almost glorifying it, and then it just goes downhill so quick.
But then you start experiencing, you told me this on Friday, like some psychosis, and
yeah, so
it started taking over then mentally for you, or
yeah, so that's what when I couldn't get at and out of cocaine, I was on a long bender, and as I said, the whole downward spiral, I ended up getting my grandfather's house. And I moved in. I said, lovely, this is brilliant, you know. I can take as much drugs as I want. Nobody will be able to do anything or say anything. And I went from taking cocaine to smoking crack.
Oh, and Jesus.
As soon as I started to smoke crack, it was for a couple of days, I'd say. Not even a couple of days. It just done something to me brain. And I can remember, I was like, what the fuck has just happened? And I was immersed in this whole reality that my family were in on this master plan with this hitman that I couldn't understand who the fuck he was, why he was coming for me, but this fella was coming to kill me. Oh, he was coming to shoot me, and he was gonna give me the worst death imaginable. And the thing is that, like, you're like, oh my God, like it's almost like you can remember certain memories that weren't there, but they're so vivid that you're like, hold on for a second, were they there? Like, I had to have went through that. Yeah. I'm at the doing something on somebody. And then, obviously, my family could tell I was so fucked up. They were so concerned. They'd reach out to me and I'd say, they're never that concerned. They're definitely up to something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which led me then to fucking fleeing the country.
You just done a burner.
I just done a burner.
And you had no money.
I had about, I'd say, 200 or 300 euro.
And what was that? What did that look like? Down to the boat, across the Holyhead?
I ended up running out of my house and I didn't know where I was going or what the fuck I was doing. And I ended up going out to, I think it's called Fairview, is it?
Mm.
And then I ended up getting a bottle of wine in the fucking wine store in Fairview. Couldn't be outside.
Did you give me shit about a
What was wrong with Linden Village? You fancy fucking prick giving me Jim about a fucking silver tray. Fucking Chablis on the boat.
Drink the wine out fucking Fairview. But I got
not a cart neither, a bottle.
Yeah. Couldn't sit outside, couldn't sit on the beach. So there's like, you never see little bushes. Jumped into the bushes and just sat into the bushes. And that was somebody's laughing.
That's fucking mad, man.
Just sat in the bushes.
It's no laughing matter, though. But like, it's fucking great to be able to laugh about it, all right? But
yeah,
but holy shit.
At the time, and it's not to be all fucking like all like that, but like at the time, you're like, this is like going on.
Oh,
so I just drink myself into an oblivion. And then something just clicked to me and I said, get the boat. I said I knew I'd get the boat. I had a bank card with me that was cracked in half and everything, and end up going down to the fucking the ferry, getting the ferry then over to Holyhead. How'd he let me on the ferry? I don't know still to this day. And then gets over to Holyhead, didn't know how to get to London.
Yeah, because you're in the middle of nowhere there, really.
Had a fella who I knew in London. I was trying to get down to him, and backstory is my family was contacting him saying, listen, he's gone off his head, he's coming down
and you're the only one he fucking knows. Yeah. And
overnight we had went into lockdown, which meant there was no way back to Ireland or anything like that. But I'm still in fucking Holyhead thinking to myself, people are coming to shoot me. So as soon as they went, because it was about 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the middle of the night, went to that time in the middle of the Holyhead sort of fucking ferry place. Some young fella walks in with a bottle of wine in his pocket and I asked him, had he got any coke? And I'm still in psychosis at this time. And your man ended up giving me ketamine and I was hallucinating. Don't know how then, made me way down to London. And then when I was in London, I had a little bit of absence from the drugs and the drink. And that's when my whole world came crumbling down. And I was just absolutely terrified.
And how did you get back home then? Did someone come and get you? Or?
So my family came over, and like the only way to describe psychosis is that you're in it 1 minute, and when you're in it, I can't even describe to you how terrifying it is, because it's so terrifying that this is, you're going to die a fucking painful death, and some cunt is coming to butcher you and your family, and it's mental warfare. And the next minute you're over, and you're like, hold on for a second, I don't think that's real. But it's so quick, the transition is.
Was that the first time that it happened?
First time it happened.
Only time?
So, like, I'd get bouts of paranoia, and a lot of young men will relate to this, and this is something that I want to get across and never did. But where you take cocaine and you think, he's saying something about me, or they're up to something more, he's at the going off my board. I'm a firm believer that they were warning signs for me. You know, they were warning signs where your brain is not doing too good here.
Yeah.
If you keep acting the bollocks, this is going to happen. And when that happened, I was stuck in psychosis for a month. A month straight.
Oh my God.
By the mercy of God, I ended up getting, the Metropolitan Police had ended up contacting me through WhatsApp. And when you're in the height of psychosis, you're saying to yourself, no policeman's going to fucking WhatsApp me. And he said, this detective is sending me fucking pictures of his identification.
I said, how did that come out?
Because my family had to report me as a missing person.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, these think I'm stupid. These are sending me little fake bleeding detective pictures. And it truly was a detective. I was a missing person.
And you got back home to Dublin then, and you get into a programme.
Yeah, got home to Dublin, got into Asheree, fantastic treatment centre. I was on a medication to try get me to come down from the psychosis, which was called olanzapine. And that was nearly worse than being in psychosis. I was hearing elves. They were telling me to take my own life. One minute then I'd be just sitting here. Next minute I'd be in this little realm in my mind. It was bizarre. But when I went down to Asheree, had expressed it to the doctor. The doctor said to me, look, we'll try to get you off the olanzapine. We'll try to. And it was the first time that I felt like somebody was actually
listening
to me.
Yeah. And were you admitted then?
So I was, you checked into treatment into Asheree, and then from there, so like I didn't realise, I was down there and I was glorifying drinking drugs, and I was actually trying to manipulate everybody and anybody around me to actually somehow go back out on drinking drugs. But I wasn't aware of this, and group therapy had come around on Monday, and the counsellor says, anybody want to say that? And he said, yeah, every one of them was like, this fella is fucking...
He's trying to start a party there. Yeah.
And then from that minute, I was just like, it was like the whole realisation had come on me.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Come here, from the first steroid you took until the day you're in Asheree, is that the right name?
Yeah, yeah.
How many years is that? Roughly.
So I'm 3.5 years sober now, I'm 30, so I would have been 26, so 18 to 26, so only 8 years, and I started off using when I was 17, 18, which is, it's actually later. very late, you know, there's kids now who use.
Much younger.
Yeah, much, much younger, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then just to, so then you went all Forrest Gump on it and started running, where did that come into it?
Because, so there's a primary treatment and a secondary treatment, and the Asheree primary is 28 days of care, where they start to work on you through a Minnesota model. It's basically where you start to understand your feelings, thoughts, emotions, and being able to delve into it. And they said, look, we actually have a secondary treatment centre, if you'd like to go there. Went there, and in the secondary treatment, they let you outside of the premises a little bit more if you exercise. So I said, I'm going to start fucking running now.
Yeah.
And I was always...
Fuck out of here.
Oh, yeah, fuck, leg at home.
Yeah. I go back to Hollyhead.
But I start running, and there was a stage then where when I was running, I was always a young fella who, I tell you, I'm at doing 20K when I didn't even do 5, you know? And I said, I'm going to go out and do a half marathon. And I got to about 8 or something, so many fucking K. And I said, I can't do this. I'll just go home and I'll lie to the rest of the lads. And something clicked in me that day. And I said, you know what? I've paid me bollocks lying. I've paid me bollocks living this life, and all I do is lie. I fucking cheat and I act the bollocks to everybody and anybody. Yeah. I just got fed up being fed up, and I made sure that I done it. And I swear to God, I'm convinced that that day was the day I changed my life.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And now there's like, I mean, I ran with you last week, and literally every couple of steps, there's cars beeping at us people stopping to say hello to you. And, you know, that whole process, which I found, I was like, Jesus, man.
It's mad the things that click with the human mind. No,
but obviously, like, but also like the way you talk about...
the openness.
Yeah, I'm putting like a positive, like, I mean, you've just told us the negative side of it now, but now your people are tuning in to listen to you talking about being positive, keeping negativity out of your life. Yeah. Where do you think all of that skill of communication came from?
So like...
Or do you even, do you even give yourself the credit of that? Like, can you...
I just think I'm just being honest, you know? Yeah. And I think that the more open and honest you are, first of all, the less you worry, oh, he's going to say this about me. I've already said it about myself, which sort of gives me a little bit more confidence to express myself. And the more I start to operate through life being open and honest, the more I'm able to communicate, the more I'm not afraid to say this or say that, because I'm just being me, you know what I mean? And just help me to be able to enunciate things better and to have a better vocabulary, you know? And, like, I'm just the umpler from the fucking flats. But at the end of the day, once I'm open and honest with where I've been, who I am, and where I want to go.
And people love that, you know? Yeah. I mean, everybody can relate to it, because not everybody can be open. I mean, a lot of them will be looking at you, you know, inspired, like going, Jesus, I wish I could be like him, or I wish I could do that, you know what I mean? So then they probably get a good bit from you doing it as well, or, you know, and where then do you find your culprits to run the 5K? Are people reaching out, or are you just building up? Do you look for one, say, geez, I wouldn't mind chatting, no more than us, want to get a hold of you? Like Gareth had said a few weeks ago, he was going running with you, and I said, geez, never mind that. You'd be deadly in here with us as well, you know what I mean? Because I'm running fucking nowhere with him. So, I was like, if he wants to talk to me, he's coming into fucking Marconi House.
I just started contacting people.
Yeah.
And just messaging people. And
they're probably contacting you now, though. Yeah. There's probably now it's the other way.
To that stage, you know. And
great.
Like, I don't think of it as anything, if I'm being honest with you. All I'm trying to do is have a laugh. Have a joke, get people moving, and just to fucking start. I've never seen anybody do it before, if I'm honest.
Yeah,
you know?
It's great. And it's not easy to talk.
How many days are you in?
Pace?
So I've ran five. I also do 5K every day. I've done that for over 460 days. And then the episodes 5K with Chris, where I start to speak to people who are public figures or of some sort of influence. Yeah. I'm on episode 59 now.
Yeah, brilliant.
Episode 59. So.
And you just recorded on your phone?
Just on the phone.
I thought now we were going to rock up and he'd be taking out GoPros on his arm and all. He's like, hang on a minute, a phone, not even a microphone.
Yeah.
But that's what was so nice about it. And look, we spent an hour or so together and it was a very open conversation about, we spoke about also, I mean, something that you said actually surprised me when you spoke about your faith and like the program that you done, like there was an element of, is religion the right word, or faith, I think is the...
Yeah, so like every sort of program through AA, NACA, wherever the fuck A you want to go through, it's basically a spiritual program. It all starts to revolve around the 12 steps. But for me, from a young age, I just had a great relationship with my grandmother, who always went to church and always told me that if you want to do something, and if you want something, well then pray to God and ask God for so. And not a lot of people are into that. But I am. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to ram it down people's necks.
Yeah.
But it works for me, and it's something that has helped me to get to be where I am today, you know. And whether you believe in God or you believe in the universe or you just believe in something, I think that on your hard days, having something to believe in or something to speak to, when you can't believe in something or you can't speak to someone, helps you to be that little bit better in yourself. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, it's not something that... you know, we were brought up very religious, I suppose. I mean, most Catholic boys were kicked into mass, like, much you'd be fucking moaning and groaning as you got older, you know what I mean? Like, with half a head on, you're trying to pretend you weren't hungover, you know what I mean? But there'll still be nights now, like, if I'm going to bed, like, and it could be for good stuff. It, like, last year, we were in here, Gaz was going to an awards night. I said a prayer for him that goes, let that cunt win something. You know what I mean? Or it could be United-Liverpool game. Or then it could be, you know, my wife had breast cancer after her third kid. Like, there was every night, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say a prayer, but I would say something to granny or grandad. I was like, oh, Jesus, yeah, man, throws a fucking bone and let everything be all right.
Yeah.
And you're chatting to somebody. I don't know whether anybody's listening or not. You feel better after it,
so
you know?
So much better.
Yeah.
So much better. And exactly what you said there, like, I think more people can relate to that.
Yeah.
And you can to the whole thing about praying, you know what I mean? I think somebody has a little bit of something in them, because when she hits the fan, you'll ask for help quick enough, whether you're an atheist or a believer, you know? And I think that's something that everybody needs in their life.
And you also told me something which kind of surprised me a little bit. He was a commie chef.
Yeah.
Imagine managing him. Back then,
worst experience.
Yeah, it's like, a dark spot if it's not for you.
If I wasn't depressed going into it, I was definitely depressed leaving it. I walked in and I was saying to him, the chef was like, "Oh, where you come from and what college?" And I was like, Foss, you know Foss?" Okay, right, Grant. Here's a he threw these little bowl of potatoes and water. And he's like, "Just cut them into flowers or florets or whatever." And I think to myself,
"What the fuck are you on?"
So he just legged her off and then came back. And I had these absolutely butchered. I butchered every single one of them. He looked at them in disgust and he says to some fella, he says, "Take him down to the storeroom."
Well, he must have been an arsehole, because he should have shown you what he wanted.
But I think like that.
How long did you last at that for? That day?
I'd say about a week. I was a week in there and I went home and I was crying to my nanny. Yeah. I said, "Nanny, I fucking hate you." And from there, she turned around to me. She says, "Don't ever do anything that you don't want to do."
That's a nice piece of advice, sir.
Yeah.
You didn't listen to it all the time.
Here they are, sitting across from two chefs.
Well, and that chef sounded like a tube, really. He should have shown you what he wanted.
Was there, like, this podcast, obviously, we talk about food at some stage. So is food a part of your life, or is it somewhere? You said something to me again. I want you to say it rather than me saying it. But
I love food. I love food, and food is something I think, like, that when you give up the drink and the drugs, you have to have something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And food is something that I love, and a lot of addicts and alcoholics can relate to that, you know. One thing that I love is when I burst my bollocks in the gym or exercising or running, and then having a nice meal to come home to, you know.
Yeah.
Or even the whole
earning the steak.
Tastes better. Even going to a fancy place, you know, and you can feel the aura and you're like, this is something special here, you know.
Yeah.
And do you cook much?
No.
You bollocks, so who's cooking it for you? Did you get that woman back?
No. I actually don't.
Found a different one.
No, we just.
I often wonder these lucky bastards that find. Like, how do you find a fucking woman that'll actually cook you dinners?
I don't.
Annette cooked for us last night. She had friends. Where do you hear this, right? And I was like.
Annette's his wife.
Yeah.
And he's about to give her a trash in here.
All right, well, there's enough for me. And she goes, and I went, well, is there? She had to take a wee second look, right? And I caught her and I went, fucking hell, you got lucky there. She goes, "Oh, no, like, I counted, you know," because she does this all the time. She cooks. She doesn't add me to the pot. She's like, "You fucking cook."
That's because you're always giving out anyway, on this.
Somebody was visiting. Somebody was in the house, whatever, and Torrena goes, I says, "Jesus, isn't it a great day? Like, I get to eat something I never made." And I says, "I'm cooking all the time." And I goes, "All right, what was the last thing you made for me?" And then she went, the thing, and I says, "Really now, right in front of," I can't even remember last night who was in the house, and I went, it had to have been a year ago. I goes, "You haven't a fucking notion, you dose." Do you know what I mean? I says, "And you just about got me a portion. It was a fucking miserable enough portion of meatballs, spaghetti and meatballs, and it was deadly too." You know what I mean? And I said, "Fuck off now," saying there to your buddies, like, "You cook for me all the time, you lying here." You know what I mean? And you found somebody that cooks for you.
No, I don't. I get me meals delivered. So I get me meals delivered Monday to Friday, and then of a Saturday or Sunday, I'll go out. But Yeah, for I live on my own, like, so.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I haven't got...
You're keeping Philly McMahon rich then. Yeah.
No, if I get to the stage where I get a woman who's going to cook for me, I'll be a happy man.
Oh, yeah,
but
man, that's a full circle, right?
Far between now.
Yeah.
And do you find that, the lure of addiction is still there?
So, like, this is something that I actually only spoke about today. I think...
Jesus, Gaz, you had to go down there.
It's gone from spaghetti to meatballs.
Yeah, straight back in.
But I honestly believe that, like, well, firstly, it's proven that once you're an addict, you're always going to be an addict. Yeah. You'll always have that addiction brain. So, for me, people used to say, it's the curse of obsession, isn't it? It's a bastard, it is. But for me, it's a gift of obsession. Because I am obsessed with getting better. I'm obsessed with growing. I'm obsessed with becoming successful. And that's why every single day when I wake up, I give me best, I do me best. I'm up at 6 a.m, I'm washed, dressed, out the door. And I want to make sure that everything I'm doing now, not a lot of people can see, but I'm trying to turn myself and me into a brand so I can create a better version of me, a better life for my daughter and a better future for all of us. And I think when you start to understand that your addiction, yes, it's unfortunate you're given it no matter what, but you can use that for good. You can use it to put time, effort and attention into creating a better life for you.
And it's sure you're proving it, right?
Yeah.
The key is to just keep proving it, right?
And is your own exercise and all of that enough, Chris, or do you still do the odd meeting? Like, is that something, I think, anybody that I know that's been an addict in any way, they still do like to go to meetings? Like, or is that something that you need, or you do, or you don't bother?
So, like, I hadn't went to meetings for about a year and a half before I got clean. And thankfully, when I got clean, then I was in the realms then for about another year and a half as well. And I just got to the stage then where, now I know I'm not trying to push this on anybody, but me personally, I just stopped going, you know. I'm well in myself, I'm able to understand myself. And that's not being a little bit, I'm not neglecting the program or anything like that. I tap in with friends, I tap in with family, I have a counsellor and stuff like that, that I'll be able to trash things out in. And I would always recommend going to meetings, but at the moment, I don't.
You're happy. Yeah.
But you're also going to spend that time with the, is it the men's shed, is that?
Yeah, so yeah, we do the men's shed as well. And you know what?
Deadly, yeah. They're amazing, mate.
One of the best ways to help yourself is to help other people. You know, and I think that's something that not a lot of people realise, that when you're selfless, it helps you to become selfish, you know, in the right way. And the men's shed is fucking gas, like.
Yeah. You know what I mean? There's some of them. There's some mad dudes in them, man. They're brilliant, you know.
Brilliant, man. Yeah. And like, do you know, one thing is that not a lot of people do these days, just have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about shite the other day, and I walked away feeling on top of the world.
Yeah.
On top of the world.
Well, Gareth was really looking forward to it all.
No, it was great. Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, there's a men's shed not that far from me, actually, and you see the boys every now and again. I think it's the Cologne men's shed. Like, it's another little village. Just, I live in North Longford, and it's just beyond me. But you'll see every now and again, different times, it's Christmas in particular, like, they make these stuff and they send them to, you know, St. Vincent de Paul, or it goes here, it goes there, and you think, geez, there's some talented dudes in there. But they meet up every week or whatever, and they've all got different skill sets, and they're all throwing it together. So I've done bits for them. Like, I just, when you said it there, I was like going, do you know what, I need to check in with them boys and do a wee cooking thing again for them, or do, because that's usually the one with that age group. They never really cooked at home, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, there's a lot, that's where they do fall down. They could build you a cabinet out of a fucking...
And even growing up, what did food look like in your home growing up? Like, did somebody make a meal every day? And
I was never left without food, like, but like when it came to sort of, it wasn't until I started to get older, you know, I started to realise like that food can be a lot more nutritious, I'd say, you know what I mean?
Because normally if someone gets into training, like, food is a huge, I mean, it's probably bigger than the training part of it if you're trying to get bigger.
My mother used to always, when I was taking steroids, and my parents also knew that I was taking steroids.
Really?
I was also so good at manipulating everybody and anybody around me to go along with what I wanted them to do, you know what I mean? I used to get them to fucking inject me at stages as well, you know?
With steroids.
So I'd ask my mum to cook me like 6 or 8 chicken fillets a day. She'd have chicken fillets, she'd have rice, and you'd be so, like, this is the whole addiction thing, so obsessed with it that you'd stick to it, plan.
See me all the time.
All the time.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, I mean, you look great, man. I tell you, one of the big sports brands should be all over you, man, because I tell you what, just from the...
It's a
very interesting story, yeah, but it's one of redemption as well. It's unbelievable, you know what I mean? And I'll tell you, I think you're going to go a long way, mate. I think it'll really grow into an unbelievable... It really will. It'll grow into an unbelievable thing, I think, you know what I mean? It's a very... For a space that's... smothered with lots of different stuff, it's very unique and brilliant in what you're at. And if ever I get to the point of running 5K, I'll give you a shout. That'll be,
you know what, he's at the that'll be the greatest five or six that'll be people the greatest. Now.
I know, I don't know what it is, man. I've had a mental block on exercise for about 10 years.
And come here, one of the questions we like to wrap up with is your death row meal. So it's the last thing you want somebody to cook for you. Or maybe I don't think you're going to cook it yourself after watching Being Thomas. So is there anything that really makes you happy, Luke?
Yeah, I just don't know the name of it. You know that pasta with the spinach in the middle of it?
Tortellini.
Oh, jeez. That's it.
That's a good one. Normally, especially anyone that's to train, it's like a steak. Normally, it's a steak.
Love
but for you, it's pasta.
Yeah, I love pasta, yeah.
Now, there's something made, right, for an obsessive mad bastard like yourself, right? Start making pasta and you'll go fucking mental. Right? It'll take you, there's years of shapes and sizes from tortellinis to raviolis to cannellonis. You need it, sir. You'll never run out of fucking road, right? And you'll be able to feed yourself with whatever you make. There's every shape and size. Don't use a machine, use a roller. I'm trying to think of the name now. There's a book. The guy's name will come to me, but it's unbelievable. But he's got the really long rolling pin. It's a really thin rolling pin, a pasta rolling pin. But you could really, really get
it's
into
only
it.
Only eggs and flour, that's all pasta is.
Yeah, so. You'd love it, I'm telling you. You'd love it, man.
Fucking
he's not convinced. I have an idea. I'm sitting here with two chefs. You make me the bleeding tortellini. Send them out to the cafe.
Yeah, well, listen, Chris, thanks a million for coming in. Hey,
thanks for your honesty. Yeah,
it was brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Top drawer.
Okay, so next up we've got our culinary conundrums. But what did you think of Chris's story, guys?
He was brilliant. Hey.
And you know what? I purposely didn't tell you too much about the run that I went on the other day.
And I purposely didn't go looking too much about him either. I know we always joke here with Ed Chef ourselves that we're two bad boys who don't do any homework. I mean, we kind of do enough that we can carry the show. But I think with Chris... or a guest like him. It was also with the chef from the bakery, what was her name, that owned
Una
Leonard, that owned 2210. I mean, I knew bits about Una and her business, but I didn't want to know everything. Now, there was lots of like, oh my God, and breath intake moments there. But even, do you know the one thing that was really striking me looking at Chris? He just looks... so healthy.
Yeah, he's a picture of health.
He looks so fit. Like, he was chatting about being worried about being small there, you know what I mean? But I used to laugh, like, whenever I'd be at the gym, it was like every day was arms day. Like, you just love big arms. And like, he's just sitting there. I was like, going, do you know what, man? He goes, there'll be nobody fucking around with you. He goes, he's all there, every last bit of him. He's in the shorts, he's in the runners, good colour, just looks fantastic.
Yeah, but look, he's really taken care of himself and he's identified that's what he needs to do now. And
yeah.
I think it's just for someone to speak so honestly like that, it was a lovely interview.
And good old crack too.
Yeah, he's
so
good crack,
my kind of dude, yeah, big time.
All right, so it's over to Ed Chef.
It's your turn to ruin the show, Ed.
It's your time to shine, my friend.
Nice segue to go from that inspiring story of a man turning his entire life around to the more important matters.
And how to poach an egg.
Chris, you've had your moment.
Yeah.
So again, thanks to everyone for sending in their conundrums. Do get them in a food@goaloudnow.com. Hi, Gareth and Gary. Number one comes in from Derry. Long-time listener, first-time conundrum asker. What can I add to shrimp scampi to make it taste better? Someone suggested Prosecco, but I think they may have been taken... Have we done this before?
No.
They may have been taking the mickey. So, Prosecco with shrimp scampi, is someone taking the mickey?
The absolute best thing to add to shrimp is tequila.
What?
Yes. And then the Palmer menu at the K Club now, I have a tequila prawn.
Yeah, you spoke about it last week.
Tequila prawn skewer on the menu.
Is it tempura or?
No. We just soak the wooden skewers. I've got this gorgeous little char grill, like an open fire flame grill. And we have this lovely linguine pasta, like prawn linguine dish on, you know what I mean? And I just like when there's prawns or on the menu, Dublin Bay prawns. Throw in another dish if it's really popular, because it just increases. Not that there's any worry about the volume, but at this time of year, I had this tiki bar outside one of the restaurants that I ran in Boston, and it was a tequila shrimp dish, and I made it with a fresh pineapple salsa. And when I was doing the menus in the K Club, I thought, you know what? It goes,
give that a whirl.
The sun was shining. I was on the terrace looking out at the 18th hole. It was a sunny day, and I thought, tequila shrimp on a second dish with Dublin Bay prawns on it. So we soaked the wooden skewers, we put the two of them through, like top and tail of the shrimp. There's about 8 or 9 in the pores, decent, and they just get open flamed. And then I have a spray solution of tequila that goes over them. They're in a little coriander and vegetable oil marinate, and then they're finished with tequila. They're flambéed with tequila, and right at the end they're finished with a spray of just pure tequila and the fresh pineapple salsa. So see, if you imagine one whole pineapple, I'll take a quarter off the pineapple. The three quarters that are left, I'll dice it up into a little Brunoise dice, a fine dice with a fine dice of red chili, coriander, and set it aside, lemon juice, lime juice. And then with the quarter that I've cut off, put it into a food processor, blend it, a little bit of mustard, and then a little bit of honey, salt, white pepper, and then I add a little bit of oil, vegetable oil. So basically I create a pineapple emulsion, and then I fold that quarter through the other diced pineapple, and that creates the fresh pineapple salsa that has a little bit of body to it. And the alcohol that we use is tequila, and it's absolutely beautiful with prawns.
There you go.
Can I ask this? This is probably an obviously dumb question, but if I had 10 of those prawns, am I over the limit? Like, I mean,
oh, no. No.
The alcohol content isn't.
Oh, yeah, not at all.
Burns it off.
It burns it off, yeah.
Not at all. And if you are, then the boss man will be shooting me for using too much tequila. But no, not at all.
So Prosecco is possible.
Prosecco would be possible. Actually, yeah. Prosecco was a really, really nice. It's just slightly sweeter than a white wine. Like, yeah. if you were cooking prawns, say, in a pasta dish, and you fried your prawns, flash fried them really quickly, lift them out, in with a little bit of garlic, in with a little bit of shallots, in with some chili or peppers, cook them down, deglaze your frying pan with Prosecco, a good splash, take all the sediment up off it, add in your linguine or your spaghetti, lime juice, toss it in with some butter, in with some fresh herbs, and then right for the last 10-20 seconds, put your prawns back in, and you've got a beautiful pan pasta dish.
Mark,
yeah,
great question, great answer as well. Hi guys, quick conundrum for you, hopefully. I'm new to fish sauce. Does it need to cook with food and soups, or can fish sauce be added to food after cooking? I'm concerned that the raw smell of fish sauce would ruin any dish it would be put in. Love the pod, Maria in Kells.
I'm assuming Maria is talking about the toy ingredient of fish sauce, I'd say.
Yeah.
And it's an ingredient that takes a little bit of getting used to, but you're really only using it in the world of toy cookery. Because it's basically used the way the Japanese use soy, I suppose. It's like a seasoning.
Yeah.
And it can be quite, I mean, to smell it on its own, it's fermented shrimp.
Probably shells
squid.
That's
how they make fish sauce.
All
so
right.
It's very aggressive, but it gives that underlying seasoning.
Unami.
That you can't get it from anywhere else. Mm. So really, yeah, there's a
and it's also used in savory dishes like meat, chicken. It's not always just fish.
No, they use it.
Fish sauce is used in pad thais, really? Chicken pad thai, lots of things.
It's how you make a Thai green curry. It's the seasoning of Thai green curry, so which is made with chicken or beef or pork or whatever you're using. But really, it's the type of ingredient that you have to learn how to use. So I'd say that's what she means. There's a raw sauce called Nam Jim, which is it's like a dipping sauce of lime juice, chili, palm sugar, fish sauce, coriander root, garlic, galangal. Look it up.
Ginger.
And that's a raw version of using fish sauce. But I suppose the other obvious one is if you're making a Thai green curry and you'd add that in when you're making the paste.
Which anybody with fish allergies needs to be really careful with.
I love Thai green curry.
That type of cuisine.
I hate fish. And yeah. I did not know.
Yeah, but you've probably been eating burgers with Worcester sauce for years, and that's got anchovies in it.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a delicious ingredient. One that I remember, I walked into work one morning when I was in Australia, and I was walking in. I was like, "What's that blatant smell?" One of the lads dropped a bottle of fish sauce,
lovely,
like a litre bottle in
Jesus
the dry store.
Christ.
In the hot day.
Oh man,
oh. It was sticky wicky.
It was in there. Just couldn't get rid of the smell.
Tar.
He couldn't get rid of the cellar, so he was left in there with a bucket of hot soapy water until the smell disappeared. Eventually, we got
but
it out.
I tell you though, whenever you, if you were to look into all the history, and I'm sure it's been done many a times, but isn't it incredibly intricate?
How to make these things? Who decides
to start making these things?
It's like harissa and sambal and all these things. They're like just heavily fermented ingredients, so it's either a
chili. How do they know to do it?
It must be accidental. How do you
know? Say so, yeah.
It's left there and someone.
Yeah.
It's like that Billy Connolly joke about milking a cow. How did they discover you could milk a cow? And what the fuck was he doing?
Exactly.
Okay, number three, another conundrum. That was from Marie and Kells. This comes in from Galway, Dermot Casey. This one might be for Gary, as I know he's a fan. I can make a killer mac and cheese. Oh. But I want to be able to make it the day before I need it. Usually the oil separates and the cheeses seem clumpier next day. I read online that sodium citrate can help curb this, but I figured I'd ask the pros. Thanks, guys.
Now, the only reason that would be happening is if you didn't make the sauce right in the first place and you didn't let the cheese completely emulsify or blend into your bechamel on the first day. Like, it should always go quite set when it's cold. Like, I mean, if you've got the right thick consistency that a good mac and cheese sauce, which is basically a mornay sauce, like depending on what cheese you want to put into it. I use usually four cheeses whenever I do mine. Blue cheese, Parmesan cheese, mozzarella, and then
cheddar or something.
Maybe a cheddar, all depending on what I want to do. Could be a mascarpone, depending on, like, I usually use a mascarpone for creaminess. Anytime I do a risotto, I would always have like a Parmesan mascarpone as my cheese of choice. And when you make it the day before, you absolutely can. It's one of those things that there's no real benefit to making it the day ahead. You'll have far more hassle reheating.
In the American restaurants, but what do? Do they make them and have them in dishes and then just bake them?
In America, in most places, they use this tin of stuff.
Really?
Yeah, they do. They use this tin of, like,
gloop,
plastic gloop that goes whatever. Now, when you're in fine dining restaurants, they don't do that, obviously. The key to know that you're in a restaurant where the mac and cheese is good is the mac and cheese is white. If the mac and cheese is cheddar or orange, you know they're using the tin of cheese that they pour over nachos in the cinema. But that's the difference. Like, that's the difference between it was made the proper way, melting butter, adding a bit of maybe chicken paste or bouillon paste to it, and then some milk that's been flavoured, like a studded onion or whatever, and... Yeah, make it the day you want to use it, mate, because it gets thick anyway. It shouldn't be lumpy or clumpy because that just means you didn't let the cheese melt. But the hassle of trying to reheat a macaroni and cheese without burning it the next day.
Whatever time you're saving, you're...
Oh, you're wasting it by reheating it at like 3 mph, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Dermot. Thanks to everybody else. Get your conundrums into us at food@goloudnow.com.
Okay, so another great episode, and really delighted to get Chris in. I know we've already spoken about him, but he was a really good guy, and loads of big things happening in his world at the moment.
Yeah,
so
thank God. It's lovely to see somebody doing so well after a tough run, isn't it? Like, it's amazing.
Power
of the mind too, hey. Huh?
I says, pardon the pun, you said it's after a tough run when he's out there running that blade in 450 days on the...
That's mad, isn't it?
So
he's a mini-day.
And he was telling me that loads of times he found that, like, there's days where he didn't do it and he just went and got it done. And it's a very inspiring story.
It's one way of keeping it going every day, though.
Start
counting the days, isn't it?
Big time.
You don't want to break that cycle.
No, exactly.
Yeah, it's not good to run every day either. Like, but look, 5K's not much, though. Like, when you do run... And you become a long distance runner, and I'm sure now he does a lot longer than 5K some days. But 5Ks feels like 20 minutes to him, probably, you know.
Okay, so look, thanks for tuning in, and as always, subscribe and share as much as you can, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, we noticed there's a few more followers coming in at Gazza Chef and at Gar Mullins, and dishing it out, spread the word, keep us on air.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.